Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. Appreciate you showing up. It is Sunday. We're all doing something. Some people are out working. Some people are like me, trying to figure out how to do nothing. It can be perplexing finding our purpose and finding our reason. And that is a organic thing that is perpetually moving. It's not set in stone. It's not concrete. I've been thinking a lot about a lot of things. but I read this bit from Sartre yesterday where he was discussing this idea of quality, where a quality is like an aspect of something, but to be an aspect, it is already perceived. And when we perceive something, we sort of cut it out of reality and we make it an object, which Sartre called nihilation, which is not annihilation. It's just annihilate with just an N. So when we have this thing that we've made, this object that we are now able to apprehend and assign allocated descriptors when we start to name it. You know, for instance, an apple is red. An apple might be round. It might be firm. An apple might be sweet. An apple could have weight. All these are qualities of an object, of a thing that we have then been able to manipulate. Like, what I'm trying to get at here is that a lot of these aspects of things don't exist until we come into contact with them. It's sort of that old idiom of, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? What Sartre said that I found very interesting was that all these qualities of an object are interdispersed throughout its whole being, if we can call it that, you know? So like an apple's redness is thoroughly imbued in the sweetness of the apple. When we eat it, that redness is still there because it's still part of that being. The essence of that object is still what it is before we named it. It contained all the possible qualities that we could apply to it. And that's very confusing. And I've been struggling with this man's work because he writes very densely and it is difficult to grasp and hold new ideas that are challenging if they're super technical and dense. And what I think he's trying to describe here is how separateness and individuality may be purely subjective and illusionary. And that means that every aspect of all these things is intrinsically connected with each other. And that harkens back to some of my favorite schools of thought, which happens to do with Eastern philosophies and methodologies. And almost every school of Eastern thought has this idea of unitarianism. No, I bet you that word's already got a label for something else. But everything is a unity. Everything is holistic. This universe is a one in the strictest sense of a one. And every time we try to say anything is one thing within this realm of middle experience, within perception, within our heads, that harkens back to the oneness of everything. And I get lost in trying to even grasp that because that thought is not graspable with normal reason. It's not graspable with the intellect because the intellect firmly exists here, which is fortuitous. Because it is through the here and it's through the now that we're able to even start to learn about this little self, this individual thing that we're making, who is me, I, you know? And then through that, because qualities of something are all intrinsically imbued through every aspect of that something, maybe to the universe, I'm a quality of the universe. Are you following where I'm going with that? And so if this aspect of selfdom is an aspect of the universe, then the universe is everywhere and everything, and so am I. And that's a mindfuck. Like, it really confuses me when I hit that wall, because I can't think past it, and it doesn't make sense. And I know it doesn't make sense to be heard, but I find it so compelling, and I keep reading more and more about it, and I keep seeing it. And so I'm reading that book of the Tao of Physics, which is, I've referenced it several times over the last couple weeks, but it's this like guy named Frank Caspra, and he's trying to use modern physics and some of the paradoxes and problems that we have been encountering since great thinkers like Einstein, and using knowledge about atomic theory and how quantum mechanics seem to interact with themselves and make particles and, you know, electrons. And now we have this image of Jimmy Neutron's atom in our head. And whether or not that's realistic, see, that's where I always find my qualms with some of these theories, is that I always found them unrealistic. And that's honestly the same label that I think you can apply to any of these mystical ideas that deal with mysticism when it comes to trying to think about our place with totality, when it comes to thinking about this idea of God. But one of the things that Mr. Frank said in his book was the statement about how physicists have this mathematical model to explain their ideas. And it's been challenged and it's been used by several different people, and it seems more and more likely to be the essential language to be able to describe this sort of space, the quantum realm, which is very different from the Ant-Man movies, which I found to be very sad. I felt it would be a little bit more fun. But they describe these electrons and these particles existing as probability fields. So they don't exist in one place. It's almost impossible as a scientist to judge where these particles will go or where they will be. And the experiments that they use to observe or measure said particles uses different types of instruments. And depending on how they measure these particles, sometimes the particles show up as, you know, units of thing, and sometimes they show up as waves. And you can't measure them at the same time in both of those ways. You can't measure its speed and you can't measure its position at the same time. So just like I'm doing now to use words linguistically to describe what the math says, because they used mathematical equations to come to this certitude, and they have like these cute little pictures where they show the probability fields. And I remember it from chemistry, and it confused me then. Maybe I'm just not smart enough. But the interesting thing that Frank said was that there is this massive gap between having an explanation that empirically, which with empiricism, we're observing, we're measuring, we're looking, but then we abstractify when we use math and we make perfect terms with units of ones and twos, and we use these mathematical units to describe situations. And what I find curious here is that we can't see it. We can't really observe it the way we'd like to. And nobody will admit that they really understand what's going on. But we're working backwards from this mathematical explanation for what they think is going on. It's all this intellectualizing, but they're stumped. And the biggest thing they say is that they don't know how to talk about it yet. And that's exactly where I think Zen Buddhism and Taoism in particular are able to lean on this almost anti-logic, which sometimes can be to its detriment, at least with some sort of forward progression if we're going to try to find a middle path between extremes. But this essential inability to describe reality, that's very compelling to me. And a lot of the time, when there's a breakdown of that descriptor, that's where some more type of real perception actually happens. And there's this whole conversation right now in the world of psychedelia when it comes to trying to interpret the meaning behind some of these experiences. And some of these experiences don't have a meaning in the intellectual sense. But one thing that is commonly described, even in the psychedelic experience, is this sense of oneness and participation in our existence, in our eternity. The breakdown of I and control and manipulation and force, we are humbled by a chemical substance, sometimes even a trauma, will take us out of the ability to feel like we have effect control, and we're no longer separate, because in order to control and manipulate, we have to be, you know, picking apart things and building things. And to bring it back to the quantum thing, like when they make their experiments, they have to put themselves apart from the experiment as observers. So you have the observer and the observed, which the observed is what they think they're trying to look at, which they are catching interesting things in these particulate trails inside those mass acceleration laboratories, like in Switzerland, where they bash particles together. They have these bubble chambers where you can look at these magnificent, like, trails that the supposed electrons are traveling through. You know, and so they're measuring something, they're experimenting with something, but they're firmly on the outside of the experiment as the scientist, right? One person commenting on this whole paradox of trying to describe what they think they found is that you can't do it from the observer standpoint. And that's why they keep getting different things, is because when you separate, you see different interrelations of what these things can do. And that's why they can only describe it as probabilities. It could be there, it could be doing this, it could be doing that. Yet without the supposed manipulator, the observer, has this massive impact on what they find. It's like to form a hypothesis is indicative of having a guess metaphysically of what reality is going to do for you when you posit that question to nature. So this scientist said that we're not observers in science, we're participating in it because we're intrinsically part of it. The dichotomy of observer and observed is a fiction, is false. And to see that put in many different terminologies, many different ways by people from the West, like Sartre's existentialism, looking at existence and being and positing nothingness and the absence of being. And you see it in Taoism with its simple anti-intellectual use of going with nature's way, with the flow, without using force. Wu Wei is non-action. And through Buddhism's essential seeing of the illusion of choice and action, to Zen's refusal of the intellect's and action abilities, ability to find reality, and ultimately falling away of descriptive terminology about it, which leaves only one thing, which all of those schools of thought, I feel, think about, even science, is this aspect of being. To look at science as a sort of game, it has to be exciting to do these things and to be on the frontier of what we consider knowledge to be. At the same time, every single one of us, scientists, Buddhists, and even ground squirrels, have an existence and are intrinsically part of this whole thing. All right, I'm gonna go grab a book. I wanted to read the last chapter of Island, which I don't think will give away any sneakers or whatever you call those things. It's not gonna give away the story. But this is the main character, Will, going to take the moksha medicine, which is a toadstool. It's a mushroom. They grow in the mountains of this island called Pala. And it gives temporary awareness of reality as it is and its wordlessness. Yet, throughout the book, it's challenged that this medicine is only a method. It's possible to achieve moksha through being part of all of our different aspects of life, which they call even yoga in the book. But anyways, I thought it was very touching. I'm probably not going to do the whole thing this week, but we'll see. Yeah, be right back. Chapter 15. 1, 2, 3, 4. The clock in the kitchen struck 12. How irrelevantly, seeing that time had ceased to exist. The absurd, importunate bell had sounded at the heart of a timelessly present event, of a now that changed incessantly in a dimension not of seconds and minutes, but of beauty, of significance, of intensity, of deepening of mystery. Luminous bliss, from the shallows of his mind the words rose like bubbles, came to the surface and vanished into the infinite space of living light that now pulsed and breathed behind his closed eyelids. Luminous bliss. That was as near as one could come to it. But it, this timeless and yet ever-changing event, was something that words could only caricature and diminish, never convey. It was not only bliss, it was also understanding. Understanding of everything, but without knowledge of anything. Knowledge involved a knower and all the infinite diversity of known and knowable things. But here, behind his closed lids, there was neither spectacle nor spectator. There was only this experienced fact of being blissfully one with oneness. In a succession of revelations, the light grew brighter, the understanding deepened, and the bliss became more impossibly, more unbearably intense. Dear God, he said to himself. Oh, my dear God. Then out of another world, he heard the sound of Suzla's voice. Do you feel like telling me what's happening? It was a long time before Will answered her. Speaking was difficult, not because there was any physical impediment. It was just that speech seemed so fatuous, so totally pointless. Light, he whispered at last. And you're there, looking at the light. Not looking at it, he answered, after a long reflective pause. Being it. Being it, he repeated emphatically. Its presence was his absence. William Asquith Farnaby, ultimately and essentially, there was no such person. Ultimately and essentially, there was only a luminous bliss, only a knowledgeless understanding, only union with unity in a limitless, undifferentiated awareness. This, self-evidently, was the mind's natural state, but no less certainly there had also been that professional execution watcher, that self-loathing Babs addict. There were also 3,000 millions of insulated consciousnesses, each at the center of a nightmare world in which it was impossible for anyone with eyes in his head or a grain of honesty to take yes for an answer. But what sinister miracle had the mind's natural state been transformed into all these devil islands of wretchedness and delinquency? In the firmament of bliss and understanding, like bats against the sunset, there was a wild crisscrossing of remembered notions and the hangovers of past feelings. Bat thoughts of Plotinus and the Gnostics, of the one and its emanations down, down into the thickening horrors, became specific memories of what the essentially non-existent William Asquith Farnaby had seen and done, inflicted and suffered. But behind and around, and somehow even within those flickering memories, was the firmament of bliss and peace and understanding. There might be a few bats in the sunset sky, but the fact remained that the dreadful miracle of creation had been reversed. From a preternaturally wretched and delinquent self, he had been unmade into pure mind. Mind in its natural state, limitless, undifferentiated, luminously blissful, knowledgelessly understanding. Light here, light now. And because it was infinitely here and timelessly now, there was nobody outside the light to look at the light. The fact was the awareness, and the awareness the fact. From the other world, somewhere out there to the right, came the voice once more of Suzla's voice. "Are you feeling happy?" she asked. A surge of brighter radiance swept away all those flickering thoughts and memories. There was nothing now except a crystalline transparency of bliss. Without speaking, without opening his eyes, he smiled and nodded. "Eckhart called it God," she went on. "Felicity so ravishing, so inconceivably intense, that no one can describe it. And in the midst of it, God glows and flames without ceasing." God glows and flames. It was so startlingly, so comically right that Will found himself laughing out loud. "God like a house on fire," he gasped. "God, the 14th of July." And he exploded once more into cosmic laughter. Behind his closed eyelids, an ocean of luminous bliss poured upwards like an inverted cataract, poured upwards from union into computer union, completer union, from impersonality into a yet more absolute transcendence of selfhood. "God, the 14th of July," he repeated, and from the heart of the cataract gave vent to a final chuckle of recognition and understanding. "What about the 14th of July?" Suzla questioned. "What about the morning after?" "There isn't any morning after." She shook her head. "It sounds suspiciously like nirvana." "What's wrong with that?" "Pure spirit, 100% proof. That's a drink that only the most hardened contemplation guzzlers indulge in. Bodhisattvas dilute their nirvana with equal parts of love and work." "This is better," Will insisted. "You mean it's more delicious. That's why it's such an enormous temptation. The only temptation that God could succumb to. The fruit of the ignorance of good and evil. What heavenly lusciousness. What a super mango. God has been stuffing himself with it for billions of years. Then all of a sudden, up comes Homo sapiens. Out pops the knowledge of good and evil. God had to switch to a much less palatable brand of fruit. You've just eaten a slice of the original super mango, so you can sympathize with him." A chair creaked. There was a rustle of skirts. Then a series of small, busy sounds that he was unable to interpret. What was she doing? He could have answered that question by simply opening his eyes. But who cared, after all, what she might be doing? Nothing was of any importance except this blazing uprush of bliss and understanding. "Super mango, to fruit of knowledge. I'm going to wean you," she said, "by easy stages." There was a whirring sound. From the shallows, a bubble of recognition reached the surface of consciousness. Suzla had been putting a record on the turntable of a phonograph, and now the machine was in motion. "Johann Sebastian Bach," he heard her saying. "The music that is closest to silence, closest, in spite of its being so highly organized, to pure 100% proof spirit." The whirring gave place to musical sounds. Another bubble of recognition came shooting up. He was listening to the 4th Brandenburg Concerto. It was the same, of course, as the 4th Brandenburg he had listened to so often in the past. The same and yet completely different. This Allegro, he knew it by heart, which meant that he was in the best possible position to realize that he had never really heard it before. To begin with, it was no longer he, William Asquith Farnaby, who was hearing it. The Allegro was revealing itself as an element in the great present event. A manifestation at one remove of the luminous bliss. Or perhaps that was putting it too mildly. In another modality, this allegro was the luminous bliss. It was the knowledgeless understanding of everything apprehended through a particular piece of knowledge. It was undifferentiated awareness, broken up into notes and phrases, and yet still all comprehendingly itself. And of course, all this belonged to nobody. It was at once in here, out there, and nowhere. The music, which, as William Asquith Farnaby, he had heard 100 times before, he had been reborn as an unowned awareness, which was why he was now hearing it for the first time. Unowned, the fourth Brandenburg had an intensity of beauty, a depth of intrinsic meaning, incomparably greater than anything he'd ever found in the same music when it was his private property. Poor idiot, came up in a bubble of ironic comment. The poor idiot hadn't wanted to take yes for an answer in any field but the aesthetic, and all the time he had been denying, by the mere fact of being himself, all the beauty and meaning he so passionately longed to say yes to. William Asquith Farnaby was nothing but a muddy filter, on the hither side of which human beings, nature, and even his beloved art had emerged to be dimmed and bemired, less other and uglier than themselves. Tonight, for the first time, his awareness of a piece of music was completely unobstructed. Between mind and sound, mind and pattern, mind and significance, there was no longer any babble of biological irrelevance to drown the music or to make a senseless discord. Tonight's fourth Brandenburg was pure datum. No, blessed donum. Uncorrupted by the personal history, the secondhand notions, the ingrained stupidities with which, like every self, the poor idiot who wouldn't, and in art plainly couldn't, take yes for an answer, had overlaid the gifts of immediate experience. And tonight's fourth Brandenburg was not merely an unowned thing in itself. It was also, in some impossible way, a present event with an infinite duration, or rather, and still more impossibly, seeing that it had 3 movements and was being played at its usual speed, it was without duration. The metronome presided over each of its phrases, but the sum of its phrases was not a span of seconds and minutes. There was a tempo, but no time. So what was there? Eternity, Will was forced to answer. It was one of those metaphysical dirty words which no decent-minded man would dream of pronouncing even to himself, much less in public. Eternity, my brethren, he said aloud. Eternity, blah, blah, blah. The sarcasm, as he might have known it would, fell completely flat. Tonight, those 4 syllables were no less concretely significant than the 4 letters of the other class of tabooed words. He began to laugh. What's so funny, she asked. Eternity, he answered. Believe it or not, it's as real as shit. Excellent, she said approvingly. He sat there motionlessly attentive, following with ear and inward eye the interwoven stream of sound, the interwoven streams of congruous and equivalent lights that flowed on timelessly from one sequence to another. And every phrase of this well-worn familiar music was an unprecedented revelation of the beauty that went pouring upwards, like a multitudinous fountain, into another revelation as novel and amazing as itself. Stream within stream, the stream of the solo violin, the stream of the 2 recorders, the manifold stream of the harpsichord and the little orchestra of assorted strings. Separate, distinct, individual. And yet each of the streams was a function of all of the rest. Each was itself in virtue of its relationship to the whole, of which it was only a component. Dear God, he heard himself whispering. In the timeless sequence of change, the recorders were holding a single long-drawn note. A note which upper partials clear, pellucid, divinely empty. A note, the word came bubbling up, of pure contemplation. And here was another inspirational obscenity that had now acquired a concrete meaning and might be uttered through a sense of shame. Pure contemplation, unconcerned, beyond contingency, outside the context of moral judgment. Through the uprushing lights, he caught a glimpse in the memory of Radha's shining face as she talked of love as contemplation. Of Radha once again sitting cross-legged in a focused intensity of stillness at the foot of the bed where Lakshmi lay dying. This long, pure note was the meaning of her words, the audible expression of her silence. But all always floating through and along with the heavenly emptiness of that contemplative fluttering was a rich sound, vibration within passionate vibration of the violin, and surrounding them both, the notes of contemplative detachment and the notes of passionate involvement, was this network of sharp, dry tones plucked from the wires of the harpsichord. Spirit and instinct, action and vision, and around them the web of intellect. They were comprehended by discursive thought, but comprehended, it was obvious, only from the outside, in terms of an order of experience, radically different from that which discursive thinking professes to explain. It's like a logical positivist, he said. What is? The harpsichord. Like a logical positivist, he was thinking in the shallows of his mind, while in the depths the great event of light and sound timelessly unfolded, like a logical positivist talking about Plotinus and Julie de Lespensne. All right, I'm going to finish it probably over the next couple sessions because it's still a got a little bit more. Anyways, that's one of my fucking favorite books of all time, part of the ending. Aldous Huxley's propensity for words and his way of describing feeling and experience was amazing and prolific to me. He is one of my favorite writers of all time, and I highly encourage you to go at least start with Brave New World and Island. I enjoyed them immensely. So that'll be it for me rambling today. Go find Odin and we'll let you go. But before we do that, I just want to thank you real quick and tell you how much I appreciate you giving me this opportunity to share with you these ideas that I find important and valuable. I want to be a helper. I want to be a source that you can lean on. I want to inspire others to want to go live creatively and find their own meaning systems, even if it has nothing to do with what I consider part of my own meaning system. I want to be a benefit to you, and I want to be a benefit to the world. So if you would like to talk about anything, anything at all, please email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. And I hope you have a great week. Please take care of you and practice love.
Hello, it's the Gingerbread Man and Ask O. How are you guys doing? Gingerbread Man, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm a little tired.
Oh, yeah. It's tiring because we're doing this on a weekend.
This doesn't make me tired. I'm just tired from the other days.
I guess that because he has a lot of work he had to do, you know? Like, yeah, a lot. So the Gingerbread Man, what about you tell about your work?
I've already talked about that enough. How about you talk about your stuff?
I don't really have no stuff.
How's school been?
Good.
Are you excited about your field trip?
Yep. I have a field trip on the 24th, and we're going on the Nature Center.
Yay.
It's going to be so fun.
That's awesome. I'm excited for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, got any advice before we say bye?
No.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.